Hello and welcome to the History of the Germans, episode 141. Rudolf von Habsburg, Semper Augustus, Alle Zeit Mehrer des Reiches. Martin Rady, in his highly amusing and exceptionally well-written book on the Habsburgs, said, quote, "The remainder of Rudolf's reign up to his death in 1291 was a failure. He did not manage to have himself crowned emperor by the Pope and had to make do with the title of king. It was a false dawn, both for the Holy Roman Empire and for the Habsburgs." End quote. I most humbly disagree. The 13 years following the Battle of Dürnkrut are some of the most transformative for the Empire and the fledgling concept of German and Germany. This episode will try to make the case for Rudolf I, the founder of the House of Habsburg, one of the most impactful medieval rulers of the Empire. Now, before we go into the story and the respective arguments, just a few words about the way the history of the Germans is run. This show is advertising free, which means the only way I can get compensated for it is by the generosity of you, the patrons. And I must say, your willingness to keep this show on the road is overwhelming. So, thank you so much. And I think it is worth it. I recently listened to a podcast I hugely respect, and that is within a network that had approached me to join a few months ago. Now, this podcast episode was featuring cryptocurrency advertising, something I personally would not want to be seen endorsing in any form. So, an especially heartfelt thanks to William Schmidt, Jantje B., Donker P., Brian A., Moritz L., and Randy F., who've already signed up on patreon.com/historyofthegermans, saving your host from shame and embarrassment. But there is some shame and some embarrassment you can't shield me from. Because now I have to make a correction. In the last episode, I described the beginnings of the Battle of Dürnkrut, stating that Rudolf's Flemish slingers hurled their stones at the Bohemians, whose Cumans and Sarmatians responded with clouds of arrows. Well, it was the other way around. The Flemish slingers fought for Ottokar, while the Cumans and the Sarmatians had joined Rudolf's forces from Hungary. Deep apologies for that, and thank you very much for pointing that out. So, now, back to the show. On August 26, 1278, the body of Ottokar II, King of Bohemia, lies almost naked on the battlefield of Dürnkrut. Scavengers have stripped off his precious armor. The great Golden King is no more. His seven-year-old son, Wenceslaus, comes to King Rudolf to sue for peace and the return of the body of his father that had been displayed in the Minoritenkirche in Vienna, a church Ottokar himself had founded in his heyday when he was Duke of Austria. Wenceslaus was allowed to take his predecessor's remains home, and not only that. He was betrothed to Judith, the youngest of Rudolf's surviving children. The marriage would take place 7 years later when the bride and the groom had grown up to be at least teenagers. Rudolf was on top of the world. His enemy and his only serious rival for the crown was defeated and dead. He was in control of not just one but three duchies, Austria, Styria and Carinthia. His policies to rebuild royal power in the empire were gaining traction, and lands and rights lost to the crown during the interregnum were gradually returned. For many in the German parts of the empire, it seemed as if the golden days of the Hohenstaufen were about to return. And for the cities in the south, Rudolf's reforms were of particular importance. As we have seen in the series about the Hanseatic League, the 13th and 14th century was a time during which new and extremely profitable trade routes opened up. Merchants handling these wares grew rich, and artisans gained access to new customers. The city's population found employment in the various workshops. Trade fairs, events that would attract merchants and dealers from all across Europe, were flourishing. The Leipziger Messe can claim to be the oldest recorded trade fair still in operation, dating back to 1165. Frankfurt Messe was founded in 1240 and is still going strong. Cities like Nördlingen, Donauwörth, Eichstätt, Regensburg, Schaffhausen, Worms, Speyer, Naumburg, and then further north, Cologne, Duisburg, Aachen and Utrecht were connecting points in a pan-European trading system. All of these cities had overlords, Some dated back to Roman times and were seats of bishops. Others had been founded by emperors, dukes, or counts. And these overlords increasingly became a problem. For one, they regularly demanded some form of tax or other financial contribution. And moreover, these high and mighty lords and not-so-saintly bishops did not understand much about trade and the importance of reliable currencies, about open transportation routes, and the rule of law. The rift between the city councils and the overlords deepened throughout the century. And the cities seized their opportunity during the interregnum, when the central authority had weakened and several of the important principalities had fragmented. Many threw off the yoke of their overlords. Having gained independence was certainly a great source of pride and joy, but it also left them with a problem once things settled down again. How could they protect themselves against the new territorial lordships that were forming again all around them? That is where Rudolf saw a way to further strengthen royal power. If he took some of these cities under his protection, he himself or his forked could fend off the rapacious lords, and in return the cities would pay him compensation for these efforts in the form of taxes. That is how in the late 13th century many cities, in particular in the southwest of Germany, became imperial cities. And this alliance between the imperial cities and the emperors became a building block of the Holy Roman Empire. Not all imperial cities paid, though. Some were free cities, in particular large ones like Cologne, Mainz, Lübeck, Basel, and Strasbourg. A free city would not pay tax thanks to the privileges they had obtained over the centuries. But it wasn't just the paper that mattered here. A great free city like Cologne simply did not need the protection of the forked against some rapacious count in the neighborhood, but smaller places like Nördlingen or Memmingen did. That also explains why there are more imperial cities in the former lands of the Hohenstaufen in Franconia and Swabia. That is where the royal power of Rudolf was more significant, and where the forked could indeed command sufficient forces to ride to the rescue of a city under siege. In the north, the king had little influence, and hence few cities were counting on a royal officer for protection. Only the largest and most powerful gained that status, Lübeck, Hamburg, and Bremen, for example. But still important places like Rostock, Wismar, or Stralsund never obtained the status of a free and imperial city. The king or emperor was simply too far away. The city taxes added a neat 8,000 marks of silver to the royal budget, which was more than the Habsburg lands in Switzerland and Alsace provided. So, nothing to be sniffed at. During his remaining 13 years, Rudolf expanded his systems of forks, covering large areas and working hard to regain royal possessions. South of the Main River, that involved recruiting members of the local aristocracy and putting them in charge. They were deliberately chosen amongst the barons and counts and not amongst the ministeriales or knightly class, as they were increasingly called. Rudolf wanted to avoid the situation where the senior lords felt he was building up a bureaucracy of men tied to him by the bonds of servitude, as the Hohenstaufen and the Salians had done. It was all part of this new first amongst equal approach. When he looked to the northern part of the empire, this model did not quite work though. First, there were far fewer imperial possessions in what used to be the Stem Duchy of Saxony. And the territorial lords there were more powerful than in the southwest. So instead of barons and counts, he appointed the Dukes of Saxony and Brunswick as the representatives of royal power in the north. These men could not be made to collect taxes on his behalf or return royal lands or protect imperial cities against themselves. But they could and they would take on the role of judges under the Mainzer Landfrieden. And that was a way Rudolf was able to curb some of the worst excesses in feuding, even in the parts of the empire where his actual influence was modest. One important feud he could, however, not prevent, the one that would become known as the War of the Limburg Succession. Limburg was a duchy, roughly between Liège and Aachen. It was one of the successor principalities of the old Duchy of Lothringia that had played such an important role under the Ottonians and Salians, but had gradually shifted out of the orbit of imperial policy under the Hohenstaufens. Being pretty much outside imperial control, several local powers dominated the region. These were the Archbishops of Cologne, the Dukes of Brabant, and the House of Ardennes, the Counts of Luxembourg. And on the eastern side of the Rhine, the Counts of Berg had a very strong interest here as well. When the last Duke of Limburg passed away, these powers got into conflict over who should take this territory. I spare you the genealogy, but it ended up as a conflict between two sides. The Count of Geldes, who was supported by the Archbishop of Cologne and the Counts of Luxembourg, was on one side, and the contender on the other side was Count Adolf VII of Berg, who could count on the Duke of Brabant, the Counts of Mark and Jülich, and importantly, the city of Cologne that had risen up against their archbishop. The conflict culminated in the Battle of Worringen on June 5, 1288. And that was a pretty sizable affair with about 4,000 men lining up on each side. And it ended in a complete defeat of the Archbishop of Cologne and his allies, the Counts of Luxembourg, as well as a minor count, Adolf von Nassau. In particular, the Luxembourgs suffered horrible losses, including several of the Count's brothers. It also rearranged the whole regional politics. The city of Cologne shook off its archiepiscopal overlord for good. The Counts of Berg hugely expanded their territory, which would later comprise Jülich and Cleves as well, bring them into the rank of imperial princes, and would even get them to furnish one of Henry VIII's wives. And, spoiler alert, the Battle of Worringen also features some of the key protagonists in the upcoming episodes: Adolf von Nassau, the Archbishops of Cologne, and the Counts of Luxembourg. Most importantly, though, the Count of Berg rewarded some of his supporters, the inhabitants of a village where a brook, the Düssel, flows into the Rhine, by granting them city rights. And because it was a village, a Dorf as it is in German, on the Düssel, he called it Düsseldorf. Whoever claimed the medieval rulers lacked creativity. It is said that the citizens, and in particular the children of Düsseldorf, were so excited about the Count's generosity, they spontaneously went on to do cartwheels on the presumably still very muddy streets. Doing cartwheels became a symbol of the city of Düsseldorf, and since I grew up there, I too learned to do cartwheels as a child, a skill I unfortunately have now long lost. But my niece and nephew who still live there are impressive cartwheelers. You see, weird German customs are not confined to Bavaria. And if you listen carefully, you may have noticed that I use the words German and Germany much more regularly in this and the last two episodes. And that is deliberate. Until the time of the Hohenstaufen, the history had been very much one of the empire, and the empire in that era was perceived by its rulers, and even by many in Europe, as a universal empire. Its language was Latin, and its politics were heavily focused on the papacy and Italy. Most of its rulers came from the German lands, but their ambitions went well beyond the geographic boundaries of Germany. The reason this period is part of German history has therefore much more to do with the 19th century historians that incorporated it into the national narrative than the actual reality on the ground. The story we are going through now, though it still very much involved the rest of Europe, is much more centered on the lands north of the Alps, including what is today Germany. Its rulers were seeking their fortunes no longer in the south, but in North and Eastern Europe. With exceptions, obviously. And they became a lot more German. Frederick II preferred to write and speak Sicilian dialect, and his chancery excelled in courtly Latin. Rudolf, on the other hand, spoke German, and he changed the language of the royal administration to German. The culture of the royal court and the courts of the territorial princes culminated in the Minnesang, the German language version of courtly love. We are in a period of transition. I came across a book by Len Scales, a professor for medieval history at the University of Durham, talking about how German identity was forged in the late Middle Ages, between 1245 and 1414. I have listed it under the book recommendations for this season on the website. And I'm still working through it, but what I've read so far resonates strongly with my own understanding, so expect more of that ilk as we go along. But before we go there, we need to talk a bit more about cold, hard power politics. And that is going through a transition as well. Though Rudolf heavily emphasized the return of imperial lands and rights to the crown, he is also a ruler in a new mold. No longer is kingship or imperial power a function of the role alone, but it now rests more and more on the resources the ruler controls as his own fiefs or outright property. That concept is known as Hausmacht, probably best translated as the power of the imperial house. Having started out as a powerful count in Swabia, but not as imperial princes, and with an income that was dwarfed not just by Ottokar II, but even by the Archbishop of Cologne, Rudolf needed to elevate his and his family's wealth if they wanted to hold on to the throne. The first set of lands and rights he was eyeing up were the duchies of Austria, Styria and Carinthia he had wrested from Ottokar II. After the Battle of Dürnkrut, he stayed there for another 3 years, bringing his whole stay in Vienna to 5 years, a very long time for a medieval king who was supposed to be peripatetically showing himself all over the empire. The reason for the long stay was that he wasn't yet Duke of Austria, Styria and Carinthia. Yes, he controlled them, but only in his role as King of the Romans, not as his own or his family's fief. And that makes a huge difference. The difference being that if a new King of the Romans was elected upon his death, these duchies would go to him, not to Rudolf's sons. So what he needed to do was to enfief the duchies either to himself or to one of his sons. And that should be easy, after all, Rudolf is the King of the Romans and as such should be able to grant fiefs to whoever he liked. I mean, that's how things worked in England or France or Poland or Hungary. But there was a problem. A problem he had created himself, well, at least to a degree. When Rudolf set up the revindication policy, that is the program to return former imperial lands back to the royal purse, he stated that all lands have to be returned that had not been enfiefed by the king and the electors acting together. So that requirement of having the electors signing off to the transfer was needed to overcome all those awards granted by the weak kings of the interregnum. So for instance, King Richard of Cornwall had confirmed Ottokar as Duke of Austria in 1269. If that award had been valid, there would not have been grounds enough to throw Ottokar off the land. So the explicit proviso that the electors needed to sign off was an entirely Rudolf's invention. In the past, most large-scale enfeefments, in particular the award of whole duchies, happened at imperial diets, which usually allowed an involvement of the imperial princes in the decision. So it was an established process that the king could not just enfeef someone all by himself. But up until Rudolf, the involvement of the imperial princes was not quite that formalized. In particular, there wasn't a list of princes who needed to be consulted. An imperial diet was able to act even if some imperial lords had failed to attend or haven't been invited. But now, Rudolf said, that was not enough. All seven electors must have had signed off. To make clear what he meant, he also firmed up who these electors were. And these were the seven electors we know today. The Archbishops of Cologne, Mainz and Trier, the King of Bohemia, the Duke of Saxony, the Margrave of Brandenburg and the Count Palatinate on the Rhine. Why those? Well, some of them have already been on the list, and, well, apart from the archbishops, they had all married daughters of Rudolf. So, what is the problem? Well, the problem is that if all awards of lands and titles in the past are invalid without signature from all seven electors, well, then all future awards also require these signatures. And so for Rudolf to become Duke of Austria, or at least one of his sons to get the title, Rudolf needed the consent of all seven electors. And that wasn't so easy anymore. As we heard last time, the imperial princes, who had initially supported Rudolf's attack on Ottokar II, but once they realized that they have made the poor count into a powerful magnate, their enthusiasm had waned. And so might have had the lure of Rudolf's daughters. Negotiations dragged on until 1282 before he could cajole the electors into enfeefing Austria, Styria and Carinthia to his two sons, Albert and Rudolf, who were to hold the duchies in common. Now, that was a somewhat unusual construct and probably came about because King Rudolf did not want to go through the process twice should one of his sons die in the still incessant warfare. But it also hints at a Habsburg speciality. The Habsburgs throughout their history acted as one clan. Yes, there was always one individual in charge, the emperor or the king of Spain, etc., But all these archdukes and archduchesses and smaller kings kept working on supporting the success of the dynasty. Sure, they had their squabbles, and some will be extremely violent. But overall, they operated as a bloc. That was certainly a contributing factor in their success, but it also explains the need to bring the meandering branches of the family back together at times. And to do that, they needed to marry their cousins, which had some well-known implications. This acting as one dynasty goes back to before Rudolf, but it manifests itself on the imperial stage for the first time here. Now, though Rudolf had been confident that Austria was in the bag after his victory over Ottokar, he did not believe this was enough. The electors had made it clear that he could not take Bohemia from Ottokar's heir, so he started looking for alternative options. His first target was the almost forgotten Kingdom of the Arelat, the southern part of the former Kingdom of Burgundy. The last emperor to have been crowned King of Burgundy there had been Barbarossa, who had received the crown in the city of Arles in Provence, hence the name of the kingdom, the Arelat. Rudolf's plan was to make his son Hartmann the king of the Arelat. That would not require the agreement of the electors, which made it easier. What made it harder was that the Arelat was the property of Charles of Anjou, the king of Sicily, one of the most powerful men in Europe. But Rudolf had obtained the support of Pope Gregory X for this adventure as an inducement for him to go on crusade. But the effort did end, with 18-year-old Hartmann being run through by a Savoyard nobleman in his attempt to get south. Rudolf was much aggrieved by the loss of this his favourite son and intended successor. Meanwhile, he had also opened up another frontier in Swabia, where he tried to gain his son Rudolf the Duchy of Swabia, that was vacant since the fall of the Hohenstaufen, and its lands had been distributed amongst, well, whoever was quickest with a sword. So to achieve the elevation of young Rudolf to Duke of Swabia, some noble lords needed to be relieved from their properties. Egon, Count of Freiburg, was one of the targets, amongst others. But this effort ran into stiff resistance from another important Swabian lord, the Count Eberhard of Württemberg. The Württembergs had been Counts Palatinate of Swabia since time immemorial and held a strong position controlled from their home in Tübingen. They gathered a coalition of Swabian lords unwilling to be expropriated in the interest of the House of Habsburg, and after a half-decade of war, the two Rudolfs gave up on that project. Now, apart from gaining more principalities, the other main objective for Rudolf and his sons was to obtain the imperial crown. And initially, the chances were pretty good. After all, it had been Pope Gregory X who had demanded that the electors choose a strong leader so he could mount the much-prophesied imperial crusade to the Holy Land. Pope and King met in Lausanne and agreed All Saints' Day of 1275 as the date for the coronation in Rome. But it was Rudolf who did not make it, as he was tied up with the conflict over Austria. And then Pope Gregory X died in 1276. Now Gregory's successor, Innocent V, was a lot less accommodating. He demanded that Rudolf gave up all imperial rights in the Romagna. That was a largely theoretical demand, since the empire had very limited, if any, influence in northern Italy at this stage. But Rudolf had just recently added the title Semper Augustus to the title of King of Rome. That term refers back to the ancient titles of the Roman emperors, and translates literally as Ever Exalted. But Rudolf's chancery mistranslated it into German as Alle Zeit Mehrer des Reiches, which would be something like Forever Augmenter of the Realm in English. That sounds equally weird in German. Nevertheless, giving away imperial rights felt hard to square with the claim to be forever increasing the size of the empire. In any event, Pope Innocent V died before negotiations could be concluded. The next two popes also lasted barely a few months. One of them, John XXI, was the only Portuguese ever to become pope, and he was killed when the roof of his medical laboratory collapsed. Then the next one is Nicholas III. He was of a more robust constitution. He lasted 2.5 years, which seemed a lot compared to his predecessors. It was also enough for pope and king to conclude their negotiations and even set another date, but then Nicholas III unexpectedly lost consciousness and died, Entering stage left, Pope Martin IV, who was another upgrade in the longevity stakes. He lasted 5 years. But that was no use to Rudolf, since Martin IV was a strong supporter of Charles of Anjou, the King of Sicily, who did not want any German rulers coming south and challenging his control of Italy. He had killed several of them already. Charles of Anjou and Martin IV then mercifully died in 1285, which reopened the possibility of an imperial coronation. Another date was set for 1287, but this time the roadblocks were again up in Germany. The bishops refused to raise the funds for an Italian campaign, punishing Rudolf for his implicit support for the cities who were wriggling out of episcopal control. So in total, Rudolf survived 8 popes, who, with one exception, were willing to crown him. But he still did not manage to get to Rome and become emperor. The implication of that failure went well beyond having to live with the diminished prestige of being just a king of the Romans, even with the sticking plaster of the Semper Augustus. Under the previous 3 great dynasties, succession from father to son was usually achieved by having the son elected king of the Romans, whilst the father was emperor and still alive. That allowed the ruling family to sort of formally recognize the right of the princes to elect the emperor, whilst at the same time ensuring the succession from father to son. But to be able to have the son elected king, the father has to first be upgraded to emperor. There has not been a precedent in the empire for having 2 kings of the Romans in parallel. And even in France, where such arrangements had been more typical, dual kingship had not been practiced since the 11th century. So, without an imperial coronation, the only way Rudolf could hope to ensure the continuation of his dynasty on the throne was by receiving firm commitments from the electors that they would choose one of his sons. At which point there is the question, which of the 3 sons should he put forward? Albert was the eldest son and should have been the natural candidate. But 2 things made his candidature difficult. Albert had taken on the administration of the Austrian lands while his father and brother pursued all these projects in the Arelat and in Swabia. And, whilst he was a competent manager, he was also a harsh taskmaster who instilled little sympathy amongst his subjects and amongst the electors. And there was the problem that Austria was the immediate neighbor of the most important secular elector, the King of Bohemia, which had historically always been a source of conflict. So King Rudolf tried to push his younger sons. First Hartmann, who we heard had died very young in 1281 by a Savoyard, and then the other, Rudolf. Now Rudolf's candidature was going reasonably well, and even King Wenceslas II of Bohemia agreed to support young Rudolf in 1290, which would have brought the votes from Brandenburg and Saxony along. And that was no mean feat, given that King Rudolf had defeated Wenceslas' father in battle, where he had also perished. But the premature death of young Rudolf in 1290 stopped this plan in its tracks. Albert, the Duke of Austria, was the only son left and the one nobody liked. Sons wasn't the only thing Rudolf was running out of. He was also running out of time. He had already been 55 years of age when he was elected in 1273. If the electors had hoped he would only last a few years, well, they must have been quite thoroughly disappointed. Rudolf stayed on for a full 18 years. By 1291, he was seriously old. Medieval rulers who spent most of their life on horseback interspersed with occasional battles did not last to be 73. Even Frederick Barbarossa, who contemporaries regarded as exceptionally long-lived, expired aged 67 in a shallow river in Anatolia. July 14, 1291 was the end of the road for Rudolf von Habsburg. Seeing his end approaching, he had travelled to Speyer, the burial place of the great Salian empress, in order to die. 2 days later, he was entombed next to Philip of Swabia in Speyer Cathedral. His gravestone features an incredibly lifelike portrait of the King of the Romans, holding a scepter in his right and wearing a mantle featuring the imperial eagle and the Habsburg lion. You can see an image of it in this episode's artwork, though you have to be aware. The rather prominent nose had been added in the 19th century, based on a chronicler who had described it as so large it cast its own shadow. So, was Rudolph's reign a disappointment, as Martin Rady stated? Now, I'm not in the habit of evaluating or ranking medieval rulers, but what I find surprising is that Rudolph did not get anywhere as much airtime in the German national narrative as I think he warrants. Not only is he the founder of the House of Habsburg, arguably the most significant European dynasty, but he also made major contributions to the political structure of the Holy Roman Empire that would last for another 500 plus years. He settled the list of electors. He established the system of the Landvogte that later transitioned into the imperial circles. He revived the Mainzer Landfriede that became one of the constitutional bases of the empire. He transitioned royal power into the Hausmacht model, where the emperor relies more on his personal possessions than the royal domain. And he fostered the network of imperial cities that is the reason Germany today has multiple commercial, cultural, and political centers, rather than being all focused on a capital city. So for someone who had such an impact on history, he does get very little recognition in the national story and in the school curriculum. I think this may have happened not despite his achievements, but because of them. When the historians of the 19th and the early 20th century surveyed German history, Rudolf's efforts to stabilize the realm were actions that had led to the structure of the Holy Roman Empire of hundreds of principalities only loosely connected by weak institutions, a structure they blamed for the delayed formation of a nation-state. Plus, a Prussian-led Germany regarded the Habsburgs, well, not necessarily anymore as enemies, but still a force that tried to lead Germany towards a Catholic, multinational, historical cul-de-sac. Now, after the war, that narrative model moved away from that nationalistic storyline, and historians sought to frame the medieval empire as a European endeavor, foreshadowing the European Union. But for that, Rudolf's inward focus and the fostering of the German identity just did not resonate. We will see whether Rudolf will gain more recognition in the future as a fundamental re-evaluation of the Holy Roman Empire gets underway. And the other thing we will see is whether Rudolf's son, Albert, the one nobody likes, will become king and prolong the time of the Habsburgs on the throne. I hope you will join us again next week.